Ball hit deep in the left center field. Wise back. Makes the catch!
What a play!
Wade Wise makes the catch! What a play by Wise! Mercy!
This is the Shoeless Goat Podcast.
Brent Brown drops the ball! He drops the ball! 3 runs will score!
You gotta be paping me! What in the hell are you doing?
Hello and welcome back to the Shoeless Goat Podcast. We're Cubs, White Sox, and MLB Podcast Season 2, Episode 3. I'm your host, Nick. I'm joined again by the mayor of Section 509, Mr. Victory Modelo, Patrick Bovard. Pat, how are we doing?
I'm doing pretty good, Nick. I can't complain too much. Looking forward to our trek down to the good old lands of St. Louis west of the Mississippi this weekend. Maybe you'll run into Yadi Molina if he's not in quarantine, and we can ask him about his thoughts on his Hall of Fame candidacy.
Yeah, I just don't need to be within 6 feet of Yadi Molina even when there isn't a pandemic going on, let alone when he's diseased like he is now.
Fair enough, yeah. It definitely doesn't help his case.
Yeah, but in any case, we had a pretty good week for the Cubs. Sox pretty solid as well. It really just kind of depends on how you're looking at it. Let's hop right into it, Pat. The Cubs went 3-1, and what did the Sox do this week?
Let's see. Let's tally this up. They started it off hot going against the Brewers, winning 2, and then they lost 3. So they went, what was that? If my math is right, we're going to go with 4-3 on the week.
Okay, so above 500, that's good for I'll continue to call them a fringe playoff team, because that's what they are. No offense. But in any case, we're going to do what we always do, weekly recap. We're going to start with you, Pat, because we did Cubs first last week. So you want to break down these games, this 4-3 week?
Yeah, so the week started off for the White Sox, like I mentioned, with a 4-game set against the Brewers, 2 in Milwaukee, which came first, and then 2 in Chicago. Monday, they beat the Brewers 6-4. Game got off to a pretty fast start with Jose Abreu driving in Luis Robert on a ground out, and then Yasmani Grandal brought Yoan Moncada home on a sacrifice fly to get the game to 2-0. Brewers struck back right after that with an Avi Garcia prodigal son RBI double. He then had another RBI single in the fifth. Ben Gamel got the lead out to 4-2 for the Brewers before the White Sox started mounting their comeback. That happened when Jose Abreu hit a 2-run homer in the sixth to tie it. And then in the eighth, Luis Garcia scored on a wild pitch that Nick Madrigal was at the plate for, which I will account to his high baseball IQ and willing that wild pitch. Moncada then sealed it with a 2-run homer in the ninth that just cleared the wall. Outside of the positives, though, the most concerning part of this start was easily Carlos Rodon leaving the game after 2 innings. Only gave up 1 earned run, but his velocity was down into the 80s, which is about 7 miles an hour lower than what he normally throws, like, you know, low mid-90s. So obviously not good to see that kind of drop-off. But on the plus side, the bullpen was good outside of Jace Fry and Steve Cishek. Tuesday, the White Sox beat the Brewers again for their 6th win in a row on the year, 3-2 game. It was scoreless early on, which makes a lot of sense when it's Lucas Giolito going against Brandon Woodruff. Both starters were absolutely excellent. Giolito went 6 with 9 strikeouts. Woodruff went 6 with 6 strikeouts. Both pitchers gave up 2 earned runs. Brewers broke the tie in the 5th on a Ben Gamel 2-run homer, but then Eloy hit a bomb to center field to tie the game back up at 2. Jose Abreu broke the tie for good with an RBI single that scored Danny Mendick in the 7th to take the lead. And again, the injury bug hit here again. Nick Madrigal leaving the game after hurting his shoulder sliding into 2nd. He's been placed on the 10-day IL but does not need surgery until the offseason on a separated shoulder. And then Edwin Encarnacion left the game, apparently injured his shoulder swinging the bat on an infield single, and he has not been back since. I'll talk more about the injuries later, but to keep the happy times rolling for at least a little bit longer, we'll move to Wednesday. The White Sox lost to the Brewers 1-0. Incredibly low-scoring game, but a very good start out of Dallas Keuchel. He went 7. At the time, the longest start for a White Sox starter this year. 8 strikeouts, 5 hits, only 1 earned run. That came in the 3rd on an Eric Sogard single. Cody Hoyer was also lights out of the bullpen. 2 innings, 3 strikeouts. Adrian Hauser, though, was better than Dallas Keuchel. He went 7 and gave up no runs. White Sox offense was basically non-existent outside of 3 hits and 3 at-bats for Danny Mendick, starting at 2nd in place of Nick Madrigal. Thursday, the Brewers lost the finale of the 4-game set to the Brewers 8-3. Gio Gonzalez kind of got to face his old team. and the White Sox backed him up early, scoring two on a Lourie Garcia homer in the second. After that, the wheels started to fall off. The Brewers got going on a Jed Jerko RBI single that scored Christian Yelich. And then in the fifth, Christian Yelich hit a routine pop-up to left field that Eloy Jimenez somehow horribly misplayed, tumbled into the nets, was sitting there for what seemed like 5 minutes, and by the time he got up, Yelich was around the bases with an inside-the-park home run, and that was a microcosm of how that game would go. There was then a walk to Avi Garcia, and then Jed Jerko hit a home run to left that Eloy could not possibly mess up because it was in the seats. A botched play at first got Justin Smoke on, and then, you know, a lot more damage was done. Omar Narvaez hit a single. Gio Gonzalez, not Giolito, was pulled. And then Matt Foster gave up one more. All was quiet until the eighth when the Brewers got three more off of Steve Cishek, who has been terrible this year. Sox strike out 14 times, 0-for-4 with runners in scoring position. Not going to win many games when that happens. Friday, we got to face the Indians in a good barometer set. The first game went as about as well you could have hoped it to. The White Sox won 2-0 after entering the series a half game back of Cleveland, so this got them second place in the division. They got scoring early, although it was on a Jose Abreu ground into a double play, which, you know, doesn't count as an RBI, but it counts as a run. Basically, after that, it was all pitching. Dylan Cease was fantastic, 5 innings, 4 strikeouts. He did have struggle with walks a little bit with 5, but it was his first really good start of the season, especially not giving up any earned runs. Aaron Bummer came on and looked good, but then he had a throwing error and immediately on the next pitch grabbed his arm in pain after it. Never a good sign. Officially a biceps cramp, but he has not pitched yet. And obviously, anytime you hear anything remotely near the elbow, that is concerning, especially for a reliever you just gave the highest pre-arb deal of a non-closer in MLB history to. But yeah, so that was not good, but the White Sox won 2-0. Saturday, series started to take a darker turn. The Sox lost 7-1. It was a bullpen game for the White Sox with Matt Foster on the mound, who did his job with 2 scoreless innings. But then Drew Anderson came on and got, he looked good right away. 3 up, 3 down, 3rd. And then in the 4th, just absolutely terrible. Walked Cesar Hernandez. 2 batters later, Frankie Lindor hit a double. A wild pitch that bounced past Grandal, scored Hernandez, and then the next batter was a walk, but on ball 4, the ball got by Grandal, which scored another run. Kind of concerning for your $73 million catcher letting balls go by him. Kind of harkens back to the 2018 NLCS. I don't really want to talk about the rest of this game, but I will note that Steve Cishek gave up another home run, which gives him an 11.12 ERA on the year. Again, terrible. Maybe Joe Maddon broke him last year. I don't know. But yeah, I don't want to talk about that game anymore, so we're going to move on. Sunday Night Baseball against the Indians. It stood up to be a pitcher's duel between Lucas Giolito and Shane Bieber, and it lived up to the billing. Lucas Giolito went 7 with 9 strikeouts and 2 earned runs. Shane Bieber went 6 with 3 earned and 8 strikeouts. Scoring was far and few between, but Jose Abreu got it started with a solo shot in the second. In the third, the Indians came back on a Cesar Hernandez double and a Jose Ramirez single. In the 6th, James McCann hit a monster shot to left off of Shane Bieber to tie the game, and then a Yasmani Grandal double off of Shane Bieber, which was the first non-home runs he had given up this year, scored Moncada to take the lead. The 8th, the Indians came back, and Franmil Reyes hit an RBI double off Evan Marshall, his first earned run of the season. And then we got our first taste of extra innings with the White Sox on this one. Delino DeShields put down a pretty good safety squeeze that scored Jose Ramirez. The throw from Yasmani Grandal, who was playing first, did not get home in time, and then Mike Freeman singled in another run. In the bottom of the 10th, the White Sox were threatening, but then the rain delay bug hit when Brad Hand could not throw strikes. They came back. Ali Perez came in, shut down the rally, getting Lourie Garcia out on the first pitch and Yoan Moncada to strike out to end the game. And that wrapped up the White Sox week. A 45-minute rain delay after an exciting Sunday Night Baseball game, the first in 7 years that ended in a letdown, which is a pretty good microcosm for how the week went as a whole.
Few questions. First of all, it's a this or that kind of question. Which was a more unnecessary tumble into the stands? Derek Jeter catching that ball or Eloy Jimenez falling into the nets? Because they both look like they didn't need to happen.
It depends on how you define unnecessary. If you define unnecessary as being showy to get the national media to love you, we're going to go with being with Derek Jeter. If you're going with unnecessary as being just, you know, basically an incompetent fielder and you know, just not knowing what he's doing out there, we'll go with Eloy. So I'll go with Jeter, but yeah, that Eloy, that was bad. That might have been the worst defensive play I've ever seen.
He looked like he was not running fast enough to where he'd have to, you know, go like head over heels like he did into the net. Like, he looked like he was going rather slow, yeah, which is why he didn't get to that ball in the first place.
Yes.
But then from going slow to just like diving into the netting, was he trying to get like a WWE turnbuckle bounce off of that? Because I honestly think he was, but there was just too much give.
No, it was, I just remember sitting there watching him, like, just get up. Like, he's going, and then you see Yelich rounding third, and it's like, oh, Jesus Christ. And then, of course, that was just when the wheels started to fall off. I don't know. At this point, just put Eloy at the line and let Luis Robert get anything remotely close to the gap. I don't know. I'm not going to call for him to DH yet because there's, like, 87 first-base DH types in the White Sox system, and Eloy taking up that spot would not be within, the best interest of this team unless he continues to either literally give up runs on a single play or injure himself playing the field. Hopefully he can just get, like, you know, Kyle Schwarber just can play competent defense.
Yeah, I mean, that's fair hope. Kyle's defense has gotten a lot better. Another question for you. How does it feel that the only reason the White Sox get Sunday
Don't
Night Baseball
even start.
Is because the Cubs get flexed out?
No, that's that. God, yeah. I don't know. We were reminded of that the whole night because I haven't watched Sunday Night Baseball in a while, and I was quickly reminded of that when Alex Rodriguez said Lucas Giolito is a two-pitch pitcher, fastball, curveball. The curveball he throws 3% of the time in 2020. So yeah, that kind of turned me off to why I don't watch it. But yeah, the question of the game was still about the Cubs. Like, the entire graphic that's supposed to be about one of the teams in the game was about the Cubs. So it's just like, can't catch a break.
Sunday Night Baseball is atrocious. I love Matt Vasgersian. I think he's one of
yeah.
the best
oh, yeah.
announcers in all of baseball. Him and Benetti together would be incredible. But Alex Rodriguez is absolutely
so
horrible.
Bad.
Why is this dude who hit 600-plus home runs get so excited about bunts and small ball?
It makes no sense.
He's like, you love to see the small ball. I was like, you never laid down a bunt in your life.
Yeah, that was weird. It was that, and then he starts talking about how, it was funny because he starts talking about how the rain delay, the advantage goes to the pitcher. And I'm like, talking about?
Yeah,
and then
Brad Hand couldn't throw a strike.
No, like, which I am convinced if that rain delay keeps going, the Sox win that game. Or the rain delay doesn't happen, the Sox win.
I'm not going to be upset about rain delays in Cleveland. Let's just put it there.
Yeah, that's fair.
So we're going to go to the Cubs. They only played 4 games because of the incompetence of the St. Louis Cardinals and how that's, I mean, let's be real. They should just cancel that team season. They just can't get it together. A couple of teams tested positive, but that's later in the week. We'll start with how the week started against the Kansas City Royals, who the White Sox just put a beating on right beforehand. Monday started off with a 2-0 win at the hand of former Royal Alec Mills, who had some inspirational things to say in regards to starting against his former team, saying, you know, I'm glad they gave me a chance, but I want to beat those guys. He got a lot of guff for that from the Kansas City fans, which there's not much more you can say. Like, yeah, this team didn't want me, so I want to beat them. How is that bad? I don't know. Jorge Soler wants to hit home runs against the Cubs for the same reason, I'm assuming. In any case, Alec Mills does get the best of his former team with a 2-0 win. He went 7 innings, 3 earned, and gave up and had 4 strikeouts. And his ERA now sits at a 1.38, which for a fifth starter who only is getting the start because Jose Quintana can't do the dishes is pretty good, if you ask me. Baez got a sac fly to get one of the runs, and KB got his first homer. So a 2-0 win to start off the series. Another close game on Tuesday. Cubs get a 5-4 victory. Kyle Hendricks back to his former self, goes 7 innings pitched, 2 earned with 3 strikeouts, and all the runs came at the hands of the home run with Kipnis, Hayward, and Wilson Contreras getting the home runs there. 5-2 lead. Kimbrel comes in and gives up 2 runs. So Kyle Ryan comes in and gets the cardiac save. So more questions about Kimbrel's abilities. He got the quick hook, though, by David Ross, which makes me, which I was pleasantly surprised about. Wednesday, Darvish does his thing, too, with a 6-1 victory. 7 innings pitched, 1 earned, and 4 strikeouts. His ERA sits at a 2.12 right now. All the Cubs' runs in this game were 5 singles scored the runs and 1 double, so they were doing it the old-fashioned non-launch angle way, which is sometimes a good way to score your runs. Mostly the Cubs have been scoring via the home run, so this is good to see. Kimbrel was nowhere to be found because the lead was 6-1, but Jeremy Jeffress in the eighth, and Colin Ray, who was a former San Diego Padres starter that the Cubs picked up last year, was brought up from the minors. He was one of the minor league pitchers of the year last year, and he closed out the ninth perfectly. So good stuff there. Thursday, I was kind of mistaken about the game time start because it was a Fox game. So it was, I believe it was a 6 o'clock start Central Time, and I turned it on at 7, and the Cubs at that point were already down 6-0. This was the Tyler Chatwood, I won't even say Tyler Chatwood of old. He just had a bad start, and everyone's entitled to a bad start, but because Tyler Chatwood has had previous bad starts, people started freaking out, which I don't think they should, and here's why. They lost the game 13-2. They scored those two runs in the ninth, so it was almost a 13-0 absolutely drubbing. Chatwood went 2 1/3 with 8 earned and on 11 hits, but no walks. So his previous implosions were walk-based and just, you know, high pitch counts early, and that just didn't happen here. He just got hit. So, I mean, credit's due to the Royals. They just teed off on him, and they were due. I mean, they were on a 6-game skid. The Cubs were on, like, I want to say a 7-game win streak. So it's one of those situations where something's got to give. So with Chatwood giving up 8 runs, I mean, the end score was 13-2, so 5 of them had to come from somewhere. And who better than the Cubs bullpen? Underwood gave up a few. Kimbrel comes in a non-save situation, gives up a run or two. And that's all she wrote. But in any case, Cubs on the week 3-1, they're going into St. Louis to play their rivals for the first time, except, like we said, the Cardinals tested positive again for COVID-19. As of yesterday, they were supposed to play like 44 game or 50-something games in 47 game days or something like that, which would mean like 5 or 6 doubleheaders, and they just got canceled again, their series. Coming up, I can't remember who they're playing, but the Cardinals had to take off again. So who knows what they're going to do. I mean, many people are just saying just don't let them play this year. They can't handle it. The Marlins found a way to get healthy and come back and start winning some baseball games. So what is going on in St. Louis? But in any case, 3-1 week, couple days off. The Cubs are off today, and they reset the rotation starting with Lester, and then they start from Hendricks over again, so Alec Mills gets his start skipped, which is something I'm a little confused about, but in any case, rotation is what it is. They're playing Cleveland. A World Series rematch matchup will be fun to watch.
Yeah, two things. First, never good when you have to take your, $13 million a year closer out of the game in a save situation. Never, obviously, the ideal turn of events there. Second, it's kind of nice you got the weekend off from having to do the full 7-game recap. I'm hoping to get that myself next week, as the Sox are supposed to play the Cardinals at home on the second half of the week. But I don't know. Based off how this last week went and the first half of this week is going, I don't see how that series happens.
I just think by the math, they just got to say, hey, Cardinals, unless you're going to play doubleheaders for 2 weeks straight, and the 7-inning doubleheader, you know, it's interesting. I don't like it. I think they're just making shit up as they go, honestly. Yep. They have to, I guess, but it's like, just St. Louis, just pack it in this year. I mean,
like, they've played 5 games.
Yeah, how are you going to do, I don't, you can't push back the rest of the season just for them too.
And I've seen people say, like, do winning percentage or something like that for the playoffs, but that doesn't make sense either. If they play 40 games and everybody else plays 60 and they get an off winning percentage, that makes no sense.
There's got to be a minimum threshold for games played in order for that to count, right? Because like the Marlins are like 6-1 or 6-2 because they just lost the game against the Mets, so their winning percentage is pretty good. But I mean, they were 2-1 when their COVID problem started, and that was playoff bound. That was like winning their division. So what if they, you know, if they just did win 2-1, they cancel the rest of the season and still make the playoffs? Like, that makes no sense. Yep. You didn't play any games, but you know. But in any case, those are our weekly recaps. Winning weeks on both ends. You can't, I mean, the Sox wish they could have done more. I think the Cubs wish they would have gotten that 4-game sweep. But Kansas City's going to win, you know, of the 60 games, they're going to win 17 to 23 games. It's just going to happen just by the math. So if you win 3 or 4 there, you're doing just fine.
Just like Hawk said, you're going to win 15, you're going to lose 15. It's the other 30 that count.
That's right. Paraphrasing there, but we'll take it. So moving on to just MLB news in general, I just want to talk about something we all can agree on. Cubs, Sox, MLB, it doesn't matter, unless you're from the greater Houston area, of how poorly the Astros have come out. They are currently 6-9, which is 5.5 back of the Oakland A's, who are probably the hottest team in baseball, who've won 8 or 9 straight. But it's not just the record, it's how their players have looked, and specifically the players that have gotten in the most trouble. Now, Carlos Correa is batting in 350, so I'm not going to, you know, not talk about his stat line, because it's impressive. We all knew he was good. But let's talk about the other three. Jose Altuve, who they say, you know, like, oh, this guy can't hit his weight. I don't think he is right now, and he's batting 182. And I mean, because he's like 5'6", so he might not be batting his weight. George Springer, equally, I think he's a little dinged up, but he's still 182. And Big Mouth Alex Bregman at 219. These guys were, you know, close to 300 batters, all three of them, and now they're hitting like this. I'm not saying that this is their ceiling. They're probably, like, if I'm going to guess, 265 to 285 batters. But there's something really satisfying about seeing this as they start the season, not to mention how the end of the game unfolded against Oakland Sunday.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, like, got to be partially mental at this point. Just of, it would be even worse if there were fans, but I don't know. We're dealing with the whole Joe Kelly situation, which that I... you know, went on the record. I thought Joe Kelly, you know, the suspension was what he had coming. But yeah, I don't know. The thing that got me about this most recent incident was just the fact that their hitting coach was the one initiating it, like from the dugout, like, you know, barking at Laureano. And then as soon as he runs at him, he gets behind everybody on the team. That just sums up, like, kind of what's going on with the Astros this year. So they're going to talk, they're going to talk. Then something comes their way and they're going to get out of the way, tuck tail run.
Yeah, they're just really holding me back, and that's annoying. It's like, it was Alex Cintron, yep. Former LinkedIn player profile, former 05 White Sox World Series champion, if I'm not mistaken, right? He was on that team?
06 is when he came to the Sox.
06, okay.
Thank God. I would not want to have that guy as a world champion in this town.
Yeah, no, not a good look. Okay, so he has no ring from the White Sox, which is good to know. But yeah, I mean, Laureano got hit for the second time. He took his base, and that's when Cintron started chirping, and then Laureano got mad, obviously. And now Laureano's going to get this huge suspension. Supposedly, according to Alex Rodriguez on Sunday Night Baseball, he's going to get the longest suspension in
That'd be insane.
MLB history or whatever Cintron is. I mean, not Laureano. Laureano.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, Laureano should get a few games. But, I mean, it's like, okay, you're just responding to other people. It's like in hockey, the second guy always gets the penalty. I think that's what's going on with everybody who retaliates against the Astros for what they did in the past. And it's like, it's nice to see that these guys that we now highly dislike are batting poorly. But, I mean, they pretty much don't care. I mean, they're still making their money.
Yep.
I don't know. It's just weird all around. And I'm glad to see that they're struggling, but I don't like to see that all these other, like, really talented players like Joe Kelly and Ramon Laureano are gonna get punished for expressing their frustration.
Yeah, especially in this situation with Laureano, because like you said, I mean, it's a coach chirping at him. I don't think you can let Alex Cintron coach another game this year. Like, they've made such a big deal about no fighting, and then for a coach to come out there and incite one, like, you can't. Like, yeah, Laureano's going to get a couple games, but, like, you can't let that happen with a coach who's supposed to be the, like, adult in the room, as much as I hate using that term in any, you know, facet of life. You can't let him just kind of drive that whole thing to a point where it bubbles over like that.
Yeah, honestly, like, if you're the one yapping, when I saw Laureano charge, I was like, all right, at least get a lick on Cintron. But there was four or five guys in between the two by the time he even got close. Like, just, if you're gonna get he was gonna get this suspension anyway. You might as well get a piece of him.
Yeah, I don't know. In another year, it wouldn't have been that big of a deal. But, like, I get why he will get suspended, and that's he being Laureano. Just, you know, the sensitivity over fighting and the whole COVID-19 era. With especially now, like, I know baseball released updated guidances. Like, if you're in the dugout, you have to wear a mask as a coach, which makes sense. You saw too many people not doing it, but yeah, I don't know. In this situation where they actually can give some sort of, warning, like they couldn't do in the Joe Kelly thing because nobody on the Astros did anything wrong in that game, at least now they can lay down some semblance of the law at Cintron.
Does the guy that tackled Laureano, I don't even know who did it, but the guy who tackled Laureano to the ground get suspended too, even though he was just stepping in front of Cintron?
Oh, that's tough. I don't know. I mean,
he did technically fight, right?
Yeah. I guess I don't know, because it's one of those things, too, where, if I were in his shoes, I would do, if somebody's going at my coach, I'd probably do the same thing, regardless of how big of a dickhead the coach was being, but I don't know, I feel like the main instigators, so it's going to be Cintron, Laureano, and then whoever tackled him will probably get something, and then The guy's out on the fringe. They can't suspend a whole team. Like, what are they going to do? Call up double A guys as well? As that work for the Marlins?
Yeah. Yeah, who knows? I guess we'll just move on, honestly. It's annoying, but
yep.
It's very important to see how the Astros are struggling without... I mean, and they said the cheating stopped after 2017, but now we're seeing, like, hey, maybe it didn't. If the stats regress this much, like, you call Colome the great... What do you call him? The great regression?
The big regression.
The big regression? I mean, this might be even worse, honestly.
Oh, yeah.
Who knows? But in any case, I think it's time to move on to our favorite part of the podcast, the LinkedIn player profile. And you should know by now, the LinkedIn player profile is where we go through the life of a former Cub and a former White Sox using LinkedIn as a primary source to see what they are up to now. It may invoke some fun memories. I went first last week with Xavier Nady Rules. So, Pat, I'll leave it to you for this one. Who you got?
Yeah, so I am going with a former first-round pick of the White Sox, a guy that people thought was going to be a pretty damn good player, Joe Borchard, outfielder. He was the first-round pick for the Sox in 2000 out of Stanford, where he also played football. His highlight of his career there was throwing 5 touchdowns in a game against UCLA. The White Sox were able to kind of Kyler Murray him in the sense that they gave him the biggest signing bonus ever at $5.3 million, except he actually signed with the Sox, unlike Kyler Murray. He hit pretty well in the minors, 295 with 27 homers in 01, 270 with 20 homers in 02. Got called up in 02, but could never hit consistently. Played in 102 games over 4 seasons for the White Sox from 02 to 05. Most of in his career was in 04 when he played in 63 games where he hit 174 with 9 homers. However, one of those 9 home runs is a guaranteed rate field record 500-footer off of Brett Myers. Still has not been broken in 16 years. It's just, it's funny to watch the video. I re-fell upon it when I was, you know, looking him up for this week. There's like nobody in the stands. The outfield is empty, which I don't want to get into low attendance for the White Sox just to keep my own morale up. Ball literally lands on the concourse in right center field, basically bounces one hop into the men's bathroom, probably hits somebody. I was looking forward, though, to the Hawk call, but it's extremely disappointing. He just says, like, a bomb for Borchard, and then clarifies it to a big bomb for Borchard. Like, oh, yeah, the ball that literally went out onto the concourse is a big bomb. But, yeah, that...
Times for Hawk Harrelson to undersell right? something.
Like, I was expecting this, because I hadn't seen the video in years, I was expecting this huge, bombastic, like he did on some of Adam Dunn home runs, but, like, no, like, just, no, just a bomb, like, 504-footer, never seen anything this long before or since at the stadium, but, yeah, just a bomb. I remember I found this interview with Joe Borchard, and he was talking about that home run, and he said it, he was just trying to put the bat on the ball, like, just trying to make contact.
He just wanted to hit a single up the middle, but, like, you know.
Like, what would have happened if he actually tried to hit it, but, alas. That was the highlight of his White Sox career. He was traded before the 06 season to the Mariners for Matt Thornton, and what ended up being a pretty damn good trade. You trade a guy that, like, never did anything in the majors for a really, really good reliever that was, I think, a one-time All-Star.
Yeah, he was an All-Star.
Yeah. I have his All-Star jersey from 2010, I believe it was.
So proof is in the pudding for the jersey.
Oh, I love those things, like the Avi Garcia 2017 one. But Avi probably won't appear on the segment for at least a few years. Anywho, Joe Borchard, after that, bounced around. He was waived in May of 06 and went to the Marlins. Bounced around in the minors after that, playing with the Braves in 08, had Tommy John later in 08, and he never reached the majors again, ending his playing career with the Bridgeport Bluefish in the Atlantic League in 2011, kind of going full circle with the whole Bridgeport name there on the south side. What is he up to now? Looking at his LinkedIn, it is much better populated than some of the other ones we found. Like some of the other guys, he lists all of his playing experiences up through 2010. In 2012, he was a baseball analyst for the ACC Digital Network. After that, he was a financial representative at Northwestern Mutual in Charlotte for a year and 6 months. And he is currently the director of sales at Ventura Capital LLC, where he has been for the last 7 years and 8 months. He's been endorsed for a couple things, baseball, sports, and leadership. And yeah, that's really about all there is to it. Obviously made a good career for himself out of baseball. From all accounts of the interviews, I could find a great guy and still has the record for longest home run at guaranteed rate field. So take that for what it will, since it's before the StatCast era. But at least has some record in the White Sox book for a first-round pick.
It's good stuff. I'm a little concerned by him working for Northwestern Mutual because I'm tired of getting those phone calls from kids that I've known from my neighborhood. But in any case, sounds like he's doing okay for himself. I mean, it's so cool to just have that record.
Oh, yeah. It's like, it reminds me of, what was that movie, Signs, when Mel Gibson's brother, was it Brendan Fraser? Like, it was a minor league hitter that literally just swung for the fences, but he has, like, the longest home run ever. Kind of reminds me of that. Like, literally did nothing else, but he hit one really long home run, and people will remember you for that.
I mean, that is an M. Night Shyamalan movie, so plot twist, he's also one of the most proficient bunters.
That would be it.
Definitely. Okay, so mine this week is also a first-round Cubs pick, and one we were all very, very excited about and never really panned out. This week's Cubs LinkedIn player profile is Brett Action Jackson. Brett Jackson was a first-round pick of the Cubs in the 2009 draft, and never really did anything with it. He came up with the Cubs in 2012. They shortly released him after that. He batted like 175 with the Cubs, 59 strikeouts and 120 at-bats, so not good. For his career, he bounced around with the Diamondbacks for a year after a year off, and then ended up in the AAA of the San Francisco Giants. Career stats, a 169 batting average, 4 home runs, 9 RBI for a guy we assumed was going to be the savior of the team. So what is he up to now? If only his LinkedIn page would load, but I can do a little bit of memory from what I can remember. So obviously, we are shared connections because we worked at the Chicago Cubs. But in any case, he went into acting afterwards very shortly. He was in not an extra, but an uncredited role in the Fox television show Pitch, which was a baseball-themed television show, if you couldn't figure that out, about, if you recall, the show about the first woman pitcher in the Major League Baseball. Only lasts one season, surprisingly. But in any case, after that, decided to hang up his career in the acting game as well. Pretty short-lived on both ends. So what is he doing now? Well, he was on the radio the other day on The Score, and he was talking about he hired a group of scientists with his father's company to study the weather during baseball games, especially at Wrigley Field, because usually in baseball they would look up at the flags and you'd see the flags and you'd know where the wind was blowing. But the air up there is a little bit different than the air on the field, so I guess him and this team of scientists had gotten together and they chart the wind and how easy or how many feet you lose or gain at every part of the outfield. So if it's, you know, blowing it out to left, it may be blowing in right. So during the game, during Marquee Sportsnet's broadcast, you can see where would be the ideal place to hit the ball for it to go out. So it's pretty, Jesus. And it changes mid-game. I'm curious to if he allows this to be used for every team. I'm assuming he does if he actually wants to make some money. But in any case, it's a pretty cool graphic that they show. And he was on the radio the other day, and he said, "I'm finally helping the Cubs win baseball games." So I think he's got a good sense of humor. He's got another couple things within his work experience, which just came up now. He was a brand marketing consultant for Bluescape Software, which I think is the software that they use. So that might be what I'm referring to. What else? A brand consultant and investor with Sparta Science. So he's getting his game in the science game. He himself is admittedly not that great with science, but he's investing in it. So investing in it in a baseball way. And much like every other, he does not have all of his baseball list. Actually, he does. I thought he left the Cubs out, but I showed professional baseball player from the Cubs from 2009 to 2014, Diamondbacks and Giants. Worked for Aon for a little bit, and actually he put his acting experience on his LinkedIn with a JPEG of the promo of the show Pitch, which, again, I have not seen an episode of and don't plan on doing so. But in any case, Brett Jackson, the once savior of the team, not to be, stolen base god to be, not to be, is now doing pretty well for himself and actually trying to help the Cubs win baseball games in other ways. So that's good to see.
That's pretty cool stuff, man. I mean, you go from, like, the evolution of stats, like, you have the whole money ball, now you have launch angle, exit velocity, all that that you're measuring, but going into, like, wind patterns and weather, like, that's pretty cool. I mean, I don't know. I feel like, I don't know how you get that information down to the field in a way that's allowed by Major League Baseball mid-game, but that's a pretty cool thing to get into. I mean, I feel like that could be a huge thing to exploit, especially as teams now seem just, you know, hell-bent on finding any statistical advantage they possibly can.
Yeah, so, like, after a home run is hit, usually they show it, and usually the spot in which the home run was hit, if it's a windy day, like, oh, the wind would be coming in, well, that's why he hit it in that spot, that's why it got out. Like, the ones that barely go over the basket, you see the wind, and you're like, oh, if he would have hit that, like, 10 feet to the right, it probably doesn't go out, you know? So, pretty cool thing. I'm sure the other teams will integrate that kind of technology if he's smart.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, but Brett Jackson doing some cool things. So, I mean, that was kind of a quick episode, but we had a shortened week for the Cubs, so that's kind of the nature of it. That concludes Season 2, Episode 3. Pat, thanks again. We did this. We're doing this on Mondays. It just kind of depends when we want to record the Sunday Night Baseball schedule. Kind of put a little end. The rain delay didn't help our cause.
Nope.
But in any case, Pat, thanks for joining me again. And I mean, next week we might actually be recording from the road, so that might be an interesting experience.
That is true. SGP goes road tripping down to the great lands west of the Mississippi by about 5 miles into St. Louis. So going to be a good time. Good to talk baseball with you as always. And we'll see what kind of creativity our brains can come up with once we're finally in person.
Absolutely. So we always end the show with a question Pat hasn't heard. And this one is actually a pretty good one because we talked about how much Brett Jackson was supposed to be the savior of the Cubs team. So Pat, who was a minor league baseball player in the White Sox organization that you thought was going to be the messiah of the organization that just did not pan out?
So the easiest answer for me for this, and the one I will always go back to and why I still regard this guy as one of my favorite White Sox players of my lifetime, is Gordon Beckham. He was the first prospect I really remember getting hyped up on the way to the majors. I remember, I was like 14, and I hearing on the radio, like, he's in Double A, gets up to Triple A. He was there for about 2 weeks and then gets called up to the majors. He struggled at first, but then had a walk, I think it was a walk off against the Cubs that year, or against the Reds or somebody, I can't remember exactly what it was, but came in second in rookie of the year voting. Thought he was on the trajectory to a big career. His at bat music was beautiful with Your Love by the Outfield, and then just never really did anything. He was a good defensive player, but never, you know, a above league average player. So I think for me, had to be Gordon Beckham, because coming out of Georgia, he was like National Player of the Year, big-time power guy. I think he hit like 30 home runs at Georgia and just never could put it together in baseball. But one of the good guys, I think. I've never heard a bad word said about him. So, and I mean, now he's been in the majors for 11 years, so not the type of player we thought he would be, but the guy's about to get himself a pension, so can't really complain about that if you're him.
Yeah, when I was working right field for the Cubs-Braves game, this was when the bullpens were on the field. A lot of the Braves pitchers were asking where I should get food after the game or something like that, which they often do. So I told them a couple spots, and they were like, oh, Beckham told us all about those spots. I was like, okay, well, I know he has good taste in food. So that's kind of cool. Yeah. Hunter Cervenka was the one specifically, and that conversation was quickly ended because I want to say one of the outfielders for the Braves at the time, one of the older guys, started a fight with a pushing match with Chris Bryant at third base, so the whole bullpen had to get running away. So anyway, it was one of those really quick, like, where were we? After, like, you just ran to go fight the Cubs. But in any case, for me, that is Pierce Johnson for the Cubs. He was a starting pitching prospect that was supposed to come up and just be a stud and never really did anything. He got a few starts with the Cubs and then just never, ever did anything. I think he had a little bit of time with the Giants as well, maybe in their bullpen. And even when that Giants starting rotation and bullpen were down, he still didn't really hack it. But Pierce Johnson is a name that a handful of Cub fans will remember as one that really bummed us out. But in any case, that's the episode. You can listen to us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, wherever you listen to your podcasts. Pat, always a pleasure. And remember, everybody, Yadi Molina is not a Hall of Famer. Go Cubs, go White Sox, go baseball. Have a great week.